Okay, we are in Acts chapter 27 this morning. 27, and if we get there, 28. As we're coming to the close of this part of our study, we're looking at and been talking about actually feeling the presence of God. And what we've been looking at over the last few weeks has been different circumstances of Paul as he's been persecuted for preaching the word, and the Jews primarily trying to stop his work, and the various things that have happened to him in these different events that have occurred, and how he has felt God's presence throughout these different events, and how God has been working in the midst of these various things that have been happening to him. So this morning, we're in part three on our study guide. Paul was delivered from shipwreck. And so what's happened is that because of the accusations and so forth that were put against Paul, he appealed to Caesar to be tried by Caesar. And so there's this effort to get him from Jerusalem to Rome so that he can, as a citizen of Rome, he has that right to appeal to Caesar, and he's exercised that right. And so the efforts are to get him to Rome. And there's been a lot of different, up to now, there's been a lot of different obstacles that have come into the way in doing there. And those obstacles pale in comparison to what's going to take place in this next part here. Really, the final legs of the journey of getting him from Jerusalem to Rome. So Acts 27 starts out with basically that they were sailing for Italy, and he was amongst a group of other prisoners that all were boarded onto a ship and to be basically shipped to Italy. And this, what happens here is a lot of, again, some obstacles that are thrown into their way. And so what I want to do is to look at what's taking place, and notice a couple of really significant things that happen in the midst of all of this, okay? So all these prisoners are handed over to a centurion named Julius. And they board the ship, and it starts to go, you know, he's talking about over the next several verses where they're going and so forth. And I'm trying to go back here to the place that I had marked. If you look beginning in verse 9, okay. Much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the fast. So Paul warned them, verse 10, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives." But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. Off they go. All right, and Paul had warned them, this is not going to be a good thing. This is not going to turn out very good. But they ignored Paul's warnings, and they sail anyway. So as they go, they face a storm. And beginning in verse 13, it shares with us what happens as this storm starts building and increasing and so forth. This gentle wind begins to blow, and they thought they had obtained what they wanted. So they weighed anchored and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Nor'easter swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. And then he goes through talking about, you know, where they're kind of sailing past and the whole situation of the storm itself and what it's doing. They're throwing cargo over the side just trying to do everything they can to save themselves. All right? If you look in verse 21, after the men had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.'" Okay? So Paul has this visit from an angel that tells him what's going to happen. All right? Be careful I don't lose my microphone here. At this particular point, how would you describe the attitude and the atmosphere of those who are on board? Let's talk about not just physically, but let's talk about spiritually also. How would you describe that situation on board at this particular point?
Desperate.
Desperate? Okay.
It seems like before they reached that point that they were starting to develop a somewhat close relationship.
Okay.
It seemed like the centurion was amenable to Paul's needs. You know, it didn't seem like it was an adversarial relationship.
Right.
In spite of the fact that they didn't listen to it.
Okay.
But as he keeps making predictions that come true, it seems like they gradually get to where they're starting to believe what he says.
Okay, all right. They're starting to see some evidence that maybe he knows something that we don't.
Right.
If you look in verse 30 and 31, in an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved." So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it fall away. Right? And I think that event right there gives a lot of credit to what you're saying, Dale, in the sense that this relationship or this trust seems to be bonding. It's like, okay, Paul, maybe he's the only one that really knows what's going to happen here. Maybe we need to listen to him. There is actually, remember, beginning of all this, what did Paul tell him?
He said, "If you go, you're going to have a shipwreck."
Yeah, don't go. Okay? Don't go. It's not the right time. But they didn't listen to him. Now everything that he was telling them is taking place, and now they're ready to listen. Okay? So they're desperate. They're perhaps cooperating a little bit more, although some want to abandon ship. I often, when I read this, and I think, okay, why would they want to jump into the sea in a lifeboat when the big boat that they're in isn't doing very well? That's just kind of me. I'm just like, I don't want to.
You generally do that when the ship is sinking.
Yeah, I don't want to be out in the ocean in the middle, any time, okay? If it's calm, I don't want to be out in the ocean in a small lifeboat, okay? But especially in the middle of a storm. Unless the ship were going down, that would be the next option. But to abandon the ship and get into a lifeboat, I'm not ready for that. Now, what do we know about these guys that want to take the lifeboat? Who are they? What group is it? We got prisoners, we got sailors, we got a ship owner, we got the captain of the ship. We got soldiers. What these guys that are wanting to take the lifeboat?
They're just sailors.
They're sailors. Okay, what does that tell us?
They're more experienced.
Yeah, these guys know the sea, right? You know, they're most likely used to storms and such. But this storm, yeah, this may be one like they've never experienced before. In fact, I would go so far as to say, if they had ever experienced a storm like this before, and then they go back out to sailing again, that's not very smart in my book, okay? I wouldn't do that. It's like, no, not going to do that again. But that's what these men are. They're sailors. They know the sea. And yet, they are fearing for their lives, right? Okay? So as they, verse 33, just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. And he says, for the last 14 days, you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. And after he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it and began to eat. And they were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. And then here's where it tells us how many are present here. There's 276 of us on board, he says. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. So here in the midst of this storm and this ship being battered, it's been 14 days they've been putting up with this storm. Usually storms, even nor'easters, and we've had some nor'easters that have, you know, hit the east coast of the United States, right? And they can get pretty bad, especially in the wintertime. They can be pretty intense storms. But, you know, for one to last that long, you know, usually storms come and they last a few days and then they're gone. This one just seems to be hanging there.
Also, they're on a ship, so the storm is probably pushing them along with it as it moves.
Yeah, as it's going, yeah. So they're caught right in the middle of it.
If you're on the land, the storm passes you by, but if you're in a ship, it can just carry you along with it.
Yeah, and it's just hanging with them the whole time, right? So, what are the things that we've looked at so far as we've read, just kind of skipping through this narrative? What are some of the things that we've read that help us to see Paul really feeling the presence of God in the midst of this storm?
He's getting updates from an angel.
Okay, all right, he got an update from an angel. All right, so that certainly is building his confidence and so forth, but what else?
Well, he has the confidence to stand up as a prisoner on a ship of 276 people and have them all listen to him as he addresses them.
Yeah.
That's not a normal occurrence.
And not only all the, but the centurion and the soldiers, who are, you know, supposed to be guarding him and the other prisoners.
Yeah. And the sailors who consider themselves the expert on the storm.
Yeah.
Are all listening to Paul, who's neither a soldier nor a sailor.
Yeah.
He's just a prisoner.
Okay. Do you see in what Paul is doing here, do you see the confidence that he has in God? You know, he tells them, God has said, you're not one hair on your head, you're not going to lose it. Okay.
But the storm itself is what got their attention, too.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, they're going to listen to him, I hope, because this is something like they've never seen before.
Yeah.
Like you said, because they were going to go get out on a lifeboat when they got a perfectly good ship, but, you know, the ship is not sinking.
Yeah.
So you know that this is something they have never seen before.
This is apparently a storm, you know, as they say, a storm of the century, you know, or whatever it is. Do you think that this storm is lasting longer than it might otherwise last because that's what God wants to be happening? And do you think that Paul sees God's hand in the whole situation with the storm to begin with?
Since all this has been set up for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a purpose in it. Chuck?
Paul had been told that nobody's going to be lost.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's what he says in verse 22. It says, "Now I urge you to keep your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only
right.
the ship will be destroyed."
Right.
Everybody. Last night, an angel of God, who I serve beside him. I mean, he knew. God had told him.
Yeah. And he's trying to share that with everyone else on board, isn't he? So one of the questions on your sheet here, the third one from the bottom on this page, when all hope of being saved from the great storm was taken away, what comfort did Paul give the people on board? And that's, you know, what Chuck is saying here. It's that I assure you, not one of you is going to be lost. Okay? Now, at that point, that's before some of the sailors try to leave in the sailboat, isn't it? So at that point, some of them aren't believing. Okay? Even to the point where the soldiers have to cut the ropes to, you know, let the lifeboat drop, so that they can't get off of the ship, right? So not everybody, has accepted Paul's message at that point, have they? But yet, he still continues to try to encourage everyone on board. Look at verse 39. "When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach, but the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bows stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf." So finally, the journey across the sea has stopped, right? But now we're run aground, we're shipwrecked. Okay? Now, as soldiers who are guarding prisoners, Roman soldiers who are guarding prisoners, their responsibility for those prisoners is what?
Can't escape.
That's number one, is you do not let prisoners escape. If prisoners escape, then you die in their place. Okay? So the immediate reaction of the soldiers when the ship starts breaking apart is to kill the prisoners so that they won't escape. Okay? Dead prisoners are better, in terms of Roman soldiers, dead prisoners are better than escaped prisoners.
Because they will be killed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, that had to do with accountability. The Roman soldiers are responsible for those prisoners, and so it's, you bring us a body.
I was going to say, this is a storm at sea. What if they can't retrieve the bodies?
Well, it's basically that those soldiers, they're trained and they know and understand their responsibility is for those prisoners. And the worst thing that could happen to a Roman soldier is that a prisoner escapes.
Okay.
Do what?
They're within sight of land, so they can probably float the dead bodies to
Yeah, but it's not so much as that they have to deliver a dead body, it's that they have to give an accounting.
Okay.
So
they can vouch for each other
no prisoners escaped.
Got it.
Okay? So as far as the soldiers are concerned, it's far better for them to go ahead and kill these prisoners than to have any of them escape. All right? We'd rather have dead prisoners than escape prisoners. All right? Because dead prisoners you can account for very easily. Okay? This happened, that happened. You can come up with all kinds of reasons to kill a prisoner. Nobody really cares about prisoners anyway. Okay? But you do not allow a prisoner to escape. Okay? So they're ready to kill them to keep them from escaping. And this goes back to something, Dale, you said earlier, we see this relationship that kind of appears to be developing between the centurion and Paul, that the centurion wants to spare Paul's life, so he spares all of their lives. Right? Verse 43, the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land, then the rest would get there on planks or on pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached land safely. All right, and that answers our last question on that page. Was anyone killed in the shipwreck? And the answer to that is no. Everyone reached land safely. So, what do we know then from reading this account, and what do we know from our own experiences, either physical or emotional, relational, any other kind of storm that we might find ourselves in? Okay? What can we take away from this part of the story of Paul in terms of God's presence in the midst of the storm?
First, he already knows we're going through it.
Okay.
And he's apparently given his consent that we go through it.
Okay.
And in fact, it might be that he plans this event
okay.
for a specific reason.
All right.
So, you know, we can pray that we are not subjected to this situation, but if God wants us to go through it, then we just pray for strength.
Okay. All right. Good. What else?
I'm still kind of struck by the idea that the Roman soldiers didn't kill the prisoners. They softened their hearts. Did they, part of me just wonders, did they actually make some sort of turnaround in their own lives as a result? I don't know. That part just really strikes me, because that is so unlike, like you said, like they're trained and what they're used
right.
to. And that they took these people that they really just considered expendable and actually sought to save them. That's the part that gets to me.
Well, another thing about Roman soldiers that you have to understand is that they are they follow orders.
That's true.
Okay, they are trained to do what they are told to do. And the centurion ordered them not to kill the prisoners. So
that amazes me. I mean, to me, that's almost because people have free will, but yet that happened. That's
yes.
that's what kind of amazes me.
It's speculation, but I'm presuming Paul probably told the centurion, "We're not going to try to escape."
Yeah.
Well, if you agree to not kill them, I'll make sure that none of them try to escape.
Well, I mean, they didn't come up with that idea. You know, that was those soldiers. You know, that's ingrained in them.
Yes.
You better stop those prisoners at all costs.
I know.
Costs.
That's what
right.
I'm saying. It's
yeah.
so ingrained in them, and that's what really strikes
yeah.
me about that.
But an order must be obeyed.
So what that means is they trust the centurion that he's going to go to bat for them and say, "I ordered this. It's,
yes,
it's my responsibility."
Well, that plus also, you know, if you disobey an order, then you die. You know, in the Roman army, that's how things went. You did not, you don't disobey orders, because if you do, the consequence is you're killed for it, period. So you know, there probably was, if you just think about it, you know, humanly speaking, it's like, I'm sure that maybe the second in command or some of the soldiers going, but we can't let them escape. They're gonna get away. We need to make sure. They're concerned about that part of it. But the centurion just says, no. And that's the end of it. Because Roman soldiers follow orders. And if they don't, then they die. Okay?
But Denise was right. You know, that shouldn't have happened. I mean, they should have been killed. I mean, that's
yes.
just a given.
Yeah.
But so I was thinking, you know, God told Paul that nobody's going to be lost, and that was going to happen. And I was like, how do we... That's important.
Yeah.
That he knew all along, and how did that mm-hmm. give him the ability to do what he did. You know, we just look at Paul almost like Jesus, that, you know, that was incredible what he did as a prisoner to tell them what was going to happen and
right.
to tell them, and they cut the ropes to the, you know, that's like burning your ships. I mean, they did everything that they shouldn't mm-hmm. have done.
Yeah.
Because Paul said, but it's really because of what God said. So how does that affect our lives? And then it's, you know, what Dale said, you know, it's our salvation. We know we're going to make it through.
Right.
We know, we're like Paul. We know God told us we're going to heaven. So no matter what storm we go through, we already know what the ending is. And that ought to give us the courage,
right.
just like it did Paul, and the confidence to speak and to tell what we know. Because God has told us what to tell other
right.
people, just like he told Paul. So I'm just trying to tie that together because it's so powerful. Of how that affected Paul, knowing the outcome.
Right.
It didn't matter what happened. Nobody was going to be lost.
Well,
because God said.
It's human nature to try to fix things ourselves when we're in these storms, mm-hmm. and that was what they were doing with the lifeboat. And human nature would have been to, okay, yeah, the easiest thing to do is to kill all the prisoners. That's what kind of strikes me about that, was that all those things that humans would normally do to fix the problem,
right.
they were told not to do it. And they didn't.
And they didn't, yeah. Here's one of the most important takeaways I think we need to have from this is the influence in the midst of all this stuff going on, the influence that Paul had on
mm-hmm.
the other folks, especially the centurion. Okay? That guided then their response to what was going on, what was going to happen, and so forth. All right, and so here's the thing we need to think about as I'm talking about the idea of different storms that we may face in life. How often do you think about what influence you may be having on other people that may be in that storm with you, or are at least affected by that storm in some way? What kind of influence do you have on those folks? You say? It's not necessarily that, you know, we don't have an angel that's coming down and sitting on our shoulder and going, hey, you know, Russ, you don't have to worry about this because this is what's going to happen, and, you know, don't worry, this and that and so forth. That doesn't happen. But we do have the confidence, as Chuck was talking about here a moment ago, right? That we know... You know, in the end, it's all going to work out. Okay? So, how about that influence aspect on other people? Whether it may be, you know, our spouse, it may be our neighbors, our coworkers, whoever it is that we're going through a storm with, or even at least that they may not be going through it, but they see us going through a storm. How significant is that influence on them? You say? And how, in what ways are we influencing them by our own actions, our own faith, and our own, whether or not we feel the presence of God in the midst of that storm? Okay?
Don't worry, you're not going to be harmed. You know, imagine the confidence that gives you. approach the situation and know that you're going to be all right. And if our people in our lives see us approaching situations that way because we have God's assurance, not necessarily about our physical life, but that we have hope, that we know, as you said, everything's going to be all right. Even if that involves our death, everything is still all right because we have eternal promises as well.
Okay.
If we let that motivate us and realize we can approach any situation with confidence that God is right there with us, making sure that anything that happens is in accordance with His will.
Right.
That should give us the confidence we need, that people should be able to see.
Okay.
In our lives, that we're not afraid of any situation. That we're optimistic.
Okay.
About it.
And how much do we feel the presence of God in the midst of that storm?
And that has a calming influence on other people. When I was on flying status, there was one time that a part broke loose from our airplane and the plane had fuel spewing out behind it.
That's not a good thing, is it?
And we were going to have an emergency landing and go down the slides as soon as we landed. And one of the guys on the crew turned to me and says, "Captain, are you scared?" Oh, why would I be scared? And it seemed to have a calming effect on them. It wasn't a situation that I was worried about.
Okay.
It was like, you know, we're professionals. This is something that professionals train to have happen. You know, what's to worry about?
Okay.
But it was contagious. You know, after that, they returned to their checklists and did what they were supposed to do.
Okay. All right. When we find ourselves in the midst of a storm, and again, it doesn't matter whether we may be going through that storm by ourselves, or it may be a storm that, you know, our family's going through, or, you know, people at work, and it doesn't matter either way. If we lose it, okay, and we don't have the confidence, and we don't feel God's presence, and we start panicking, and we start falling apart, and we start, you know, eating our own, kind of, you know what I mean by that, then what does that do to either those who are observing us go through the storm, or those who are in the storm with us?
For one thing, you lose your focus.
Okay.
That's something that Dale had to teach me all through the years, is because I was always the panic type. You
okay.
lose your focus. You're not working towards a resolution at all.
Okay.
Not that, and you may not have one at that point, but, you know, still, you're not focused on what you really need to be focused on. And I used to tell the girls this, you know, the famous scene from Gone with the Wind where Chrissy says, "I don't know nothing about birth and no babies," that kind of
right.
stuff. And they would start in this, "You can't go Chrissy on me right now. It won't,
okay.
it's not going to fix anything." And not that we can necessarily fix it, but sometimes there is something there that we may not be seeing because we're so focused on panicking
okay.
and worry and that sort of thing. And I think you expend all your energy on that.
Okay.
That's part of the problem, too.
All right. And what does that do to other people?
Oh, it's contagious. They get it, too.
Yeah. So, like, if Dale would have responded to this guy that asked him, "Captain, are you scared?" And he'd go, "I'm scared to death. I'm scared out of my boots." What would that have done to everybody else on the crew?
Since he was the boss.
Yeah, and so everybody on the crew likely would have, you know, been panicking and scared and, you know, and so forth. And then that, what happens then? All the training is gone because we're not focused, as you said, on what we've been trained to do. It's like we're just all scared for our lives.
You do what
okay.
you can.
All right.
God has the controls, but you have a little piece there that you have to focus on.
Okay.
And that may just be keeping people calm, but whatever
okay.
that is, you got to focus on that.
Okay.
And you can't do that
if you're panicking. Amy?
I've been trying real hard on this, letting go and let God.
Okay.
Saying let God have it, because with the storms that we're facing right now at my house,
okay.
Mom's stressing out on everything, and she's having trouble sleeping because she's worried about Jared. And I'm like, you can't do that too. You have to let go and let God have it too.
Okay.
I don't let go
Okay.
And I can't be a basket case too, because we can't have three basket cases in one house, which is more work.
Basket's not big enough, is it?
The basket's not big
enough. And it's easy to say. It's easy to say. It's not easy to do. Right.
I get up every morning and I pray to God and I let him have it because I have to.
Okay. I was just ready to ask you, what's the response? It helps, doesn't it?
It says, I'm not responsible for it all.
That's right.
So I've been calm. I've been clear-headed.
Okay.
And it's been so much easier on me that I'm not responsible for it all.
Okay. All right. And here's one of the most important things about it is that we have to keep in mind, again, it's about our influence on other people. Especially when other people know we claim to be a Christian, okay, but yet they see us not handling the storm very well, you know, what does that say about our faith? And you've heard me say it before, put it kind of this way, you know, our faith isn't really that good if it only works when everything's going well, okay? Our faith is tested when things aren't going well. And if we fall apart and we lose our faith in the middle of a storm, then our faith is not very good. All right, Chuck?
Well, that's true, but man, we're all going to fail.
Yes.
And Satan wants us to stay in. But the amazing thing about our Father in heaven is that He is faithful, mm-hmm. and He lifts you up. That can also be, you can rise. He will lift you up because mm-hmm. you can't give up. You can't say, well, I failed.
Right.
You know, how can I show my face in front of all these? No.
No.
He lifts you up. After you fall on your face and your faith is exposed as weak.
Yep.
And He lifts you up. And that strength, His ability to take us failures.
when we do fail in the midst of the storm.
When we do fail.
Right.
And bring us back in. It's just amazing.
Absolutely.
And a faith builder.
Absolutely.
And as a parent, especially as the mom, we have to be careful because if we start to show that panicky stuff, it starts to rub off on our, mm-hmm. our children. And as a child that grew up in a lot of dysfunction, I tell you, that's not fun.
Right.
And that's the hard part. You can't hide everything from them because, for one thing, they need to see some conflict in your life and see how you handle it.
Yeah, they've got to see reality.
You've got to see reality, but the other time you don't want to load it on them.
Right.
And that's where the hard part is, where you're living with that. And you're trying to keep that balance.
But you don't want to give your kid all your neuroses.
No.
Right. Okay, real quickly, the last part of this, and then really the last part of Acts, chapter 28 here, is Paul eventually getting to Rome. So they're ashore on Malta. There's some events that take place where, you know, the people there welcome them in and take care of them. They feed them. They get them warm. Paul is gathering some wood for a fire, and he puts some stuff on there, and a viper comes out of there and bites him. And the immediate reaction of the people there is, this guy must be a murderer because, you know, even though he escaped the shipwreck, you know, God's finally caught up with him and he's going to die, but he doesn't. And so now, since he hasn't died from this viper, their opinion of him has changed from one point all the way to the other extreme, and now he's not a murderer, he's what? He's a god, okay? He's, you know... No human could survive that kind of a thing. There's an event where he ends up healing one of the, I think it's his the father of one of the chief official of the island. He heals him. And so there's a lot of good things that are happening there on the island of Malta and the influence that Paul has with the people there. He's able to tell them some things about the Lord and so forth. And then from there, they gather. They're able to get another ship, and they gather, and they end up going to Rome. And the book of Acts concludes with Paul being there in Rome. He is under guard, but basically he's living in, and it tells us he has his own rented house, and he's apparently pretty free to come and go, but he's always got a guard watching him. What does that tell us about how concerned the Roman authorities were with this criminal that they had to bring?
In house arrest?
Yeah, basically that's what it was, but it was like, this is like the nicest federal prison that you could ever go to, okay, where you've got all of the amenities that you want, and it's like you're not even in jail anyway. The other thing is that what happens is Paul begins to teach the Jews there in Rome. He's able to meet with some of them and explain to them, you know, why he's there. And their response initially is, we haven't heard anything from the Jews in Jerusalem, so we don't have a complaint against you. And they're open to listening to what Paul has to say. Some of them believe, some of them do not believe. All right? But ultimately, Paul, the book ends with Paul telling us that Paul was there for 2 years, all right, and he's basically able to teach and preach at will. People are coming to him, and he's able to share the gospel message as much as he wants. And apparently, because of the way that the book ends, I think it's very reasonable to assume that from there, Paul eventually was released and was able to go about doing some other work, perhaps visited Spain. Don't know for sure that he did, but there's a good possibility that he did. But he was able to continue for some time with his missionary work. All right? So that brings us to the conclusion of this part of our study in Acts. And so next time, we're going to look at lesson 11 and just kind of finish up this series and talking about foreign missions in general. All right? So thank you all very much. Appreciate it, your input.